time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for August 10th, 2019. Let me begin by apologizing to all of those listeners who usually hear the show via broadcast on WJCU 88.7 FM Saturday mornings at 7:30. Last Saturday, there was a snafu at the station, and most of the morning shows never aired. You did get to hear some nice music, though. The mistake was human error, go figure, and the problem has been resolved, we hope. If you are a regular listener via the radio and want to hear last week's show, you can go to your computer, type in wjcu.org, find the Outspoken Cyclist show link, and click the play button on the August 3rd episode. The show will stream for you from your computer. So that said, this week we have two very different conversations for you. One about a book, but not really all about a book, and another with our friend Dr. Jonathan Hirsch, but not really about orthopedic matters. Cryptic enough for you? Okay, let's start with Dr. Hirsch. We had already decided we were going to discuss what happens in crashes and emergency-type treatments when he had an incident last Sunday that really disturbed him, and he wanted to discuss it. Fortunately, he wasn't injured, and he didn't crash. But what might have happened has spurred him to take on an advocacy role in his home state of Florida, which touts the depressing statistic of being the deadliest state in the U.S. in which to ride your bike. We'll get to that conversation in a moment. After we talk to Dr. Hirsch, and after we take a break, including some cycling news, we'll head to the U.K. for a long-awaited chat with Luke Edwards-Evans about his new book, The Official Tour de France Bike Maintenance Book. Luke isn't a mechanic. He's a journalist. And I couldn't remember where I'd seen his name besides on the cover of the book. But as we started talking, I realized he'd been the editor of Winning Magazine and a past editor of Cycle Sport. Luke and I cover a lot of territory in our lively conversation, including some of his roles in the cycling world. And oh yes, we actually talk about the book too. So it's off to Parkland, Florida for our final 2019 chat with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. Hey, Dr. Hirsch, welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. It's time for us to talk again this month. How are you?
I'm great, Diane. How are you?
Good. You're still in a rainstorm? It is Florida.
It's Florida. It's the afternoon showers.
Right. So, you know, we've been talking for the last several months. Each month we picked a topic. We've done knees and we've done shoulders and we've done hips. And then while we were talking, you had this idea that we might want to talk about what happens in a crash, in an accident in some cases, and what to do. And then this past Sunday, you had an incident that you wrote to me about, and I want to talk about that because that may turn into a different conversation, one that you and I both have a great interest in, riders, cars, and local government. So why don't you relay the incident that you had that will kind of segue into that?
Oh, sure. So I was riding in my local neighborhood. I live in Parkland, Florida. It's pretty residential, and so just kind of going. We basically have one hill in the whole town, so I was going down the hill, you know, maybe 20 miles an hour. Nobody, no cars around, no bicyclists, no runners, broad daylight. And on the side of the road, there's trees. And those trees, if the branches aren't trimmed, you know, some will grow right into the bike lane. So as I'm going 22 miles an hour, two trees in a row, the branches have not been trimmed by the county or the city. And they're basically right over the bike lane, below my head level. And, you know, I'm here I am going really fast. I had a very split decision to make, try to duck, which was basically impossible, get practically beheaded or swerve into potential traffic. So I looked through my little rearview mirror, which I bought from you, which is still working awesome, and there was no one coming, thank God, and I swerved. And then I had to swerve again right after it because it was a second. And because there's so much greenery and foliage, you can't see it coming because it's camouflaged by, within the distance, the other green, everything's very green and trees, et cetera. So just that alone, you know, brought my attention again to how even in no traffic, broad daylight, not a car, not a bike around, biking can be quite dangerous if it's not taken care of for us in a way that it should be, as simple as trim the trees in a bike lane. Sometimes I'll be riding and there's a couple of 2x4s in the bike lane and God knows where they came from and you're going relatively fast. And you know, that alone can cause maiming or death in a split second. And it's not even a car situation in my situation. And so it's really a very disturbing, very scary situation.
Well, it's interesting. You're talking about a bike lane. So you know that in New York City, there are myriad bike lanes. And one of the big arguments there is that even the police park in the bike lanes and then the cyclists have to go around them. So, you know, in your case, fortunately, there was nobody coming. But this idea that the city has or the whoever is the authority has some responsibility, what have you done about that? Have you done anything?
I've done some contacts about this thing happening and about biking in South Florida in general. In my research, I've discovered, and I hate to be number one on bad lists, Florida is by far the highest death rate of cyclists in the country.
That is true.
We could talk about some of the reasons. So, you know, living in a state where, unfortunately, we have a higher rate of death, not just injury on bicycles compared to the rest of the country, you know, sort of puts me on alert. I recently had an older patient in his 70s who I operated on his knee, was so excited to get back to biking. I cleared him on a Monday. On a Wednesday, he goes out in Boynton Beach, Florida. It's a large sort of retirement community, makes a right turn out of his community, gets hit by a car, and gets killed instantaneously.
Oh, no.
I was devastated. Just a nice man, amazing family, and in a split second, gone, just trying to exercise and get back to what he loves. And so many people down here love cycling. And the more crowded it gets, there's really less place for us to go with our bicycles and feel safe. And so my goal is to meet with state congressmen and try to deal with this on a, you know, really on a government level, because, you know, you can paint nice white lines in the road and quote unquote call them bike lanes, but if they're not taken care of, if they're on crowded roads, they're not separate bike lanes. They're not protected. You know, there's no invisible shield. Even if you're in the bike lane, and we could talk about it, just like my tree in my way, there's so many dangers that I almost think that in areas like here, the bikes need to be brought off the roads. We need a place that's paved away from the cars, away from the distraction of cars. And I'm not sure that's going to happen here, but I think the mixture of cars and bicycles, even with beautiful bike lanes, is becoming an enormous challenge. And I think there's three elements to that, as you said, the bikers themselves, the cars, and the government.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. He is an orthopedic specialist in Boca Raton, Florida. He lives in Parkland, and I think we all know that name for a lot of reasons, not all of them good. And we are not talking necessarily about the work that he does as an orthopedic specialist, but we're talking about the fact that he's a cyclist and he's running into the same things many of us run into, and that is issues with drivers, with government, and with riding. So let me ask you a question about your local government and the form of it. Do you have like city council and Congress, how does Florida government work and local government in particular?
Yeah, we have certainly the city of Parkland. So we have a mayor, we have an assistant mayor, and we have all the local, quote unquote, government that takes care of probably the local roads and the schools. And then we have a county government that we're within a county. And then you have the state. So there's, you know, the roads probably come under a little bit of county and state jurisdiction, a little bit more than I'm assuming city. or they may be in overlapping jurisdictions. And, you know, if you're asking them to now create, like they have in Virginia, let's say, an enormous, you know, off-road cycling path, you know, where does that funding come from? Is it city, county, state, combination, private ventures? It's going to, you know, if that's something that we want to do here in South Florida, it's going to take an effort speaking to lots of different people. I think there are certain things that could be done for free, you know, talking to my fellow cyclists. You know, I ride on A1A on the weekend. Basically, if you've ever been to South Florida, it's basically Ocean Boulevard overlooking the ocean. It's beautiful. There are portions of it, there actually is no bike lane, or there's a bike lane big enough for one bike. And, you know, Saturday and Sunday, and I do not join Pelotons, but, you know, the 40 to 60 rider Pelotons are, in my opinion, extremely irresponsible, many of them. They have this attitude that the road is ours. It's Saturday morning. They're competing for the road with cars that may or may not understand the rules of the road. But, you know, they cut me off all the time as these large, you know, Pelotons swing by at 30, 35 miles an hour. They don't pay attention to even other lone cyclists like myself as they swerve in and out of the bike lane, you know, double, triple, quadruple abreast when you're really only supposed to be single. And I think that that also creates sort of a road rage mentality amongst the frustrated cars who are going, you know, 20 miles an hour on a single lane road because these cyclists take up the whole place. Now, I get it. There's nowhere else for them to go, but they're not always the most responsible about changing lanes. And it's a problem. It's like oil and vinegar. It just doesn't mix on the roads of a crowded area. You know, I go to North Carolina to ride sometimes. I used to live there. Those country roads are made for large pelotons of cyclists, but not large metropolitan areas, unfortunately, in my opinion.
So I don't know if you know about this, but the Senate has a transportation bill in front of it, and it actually passed it. Whether it's going to get past the House or not is, of course, nothing seems to get past the House of Representatives these days. But it's a great bill for cycling, believe it or not. It's good for bikes. There's a lot of infrastructure that's being proposed and actually voted on as a yes. But if you're saying that the roads in Parkland or in southern Florida are already not suitable for the kinds of riding that these large groups of riders are doing, what do you see as an alternative in Florida if there is one?
Well, I know near me, I actually live right next to the Everglades, and there's there's several paths through the Everglades that are mostly gravel. There are some paved sections, but mostly gravel, and it's completely off the roads. And, you know, I've looked at that and said, well, why couldn't this be paved? It goes through the Everglades from north to south, east and west, forever. There's absolutely nothing other than wildlife. That would be the best use of that land, in my opinion, because it is a bike path already, but it's only a gravel path, which not everyone feels comfortable doing. But if, you know, that, to me, pave that. It would be like what they've done in Virginia and other parts of the country. I know there's a bike path being planned across the United States.
Right.
Now, circuitously using old railroad tracks, et cetera. We even have that in northern Florida. I've driven the one in Gainesville, Florida, which is about 40, I think it's 40 miles total. It's an old railroad that created a path for cyclists completely off-road.
Okay.
And so they exist in pockets, you know?
Right.
But where I live, between Miami to West Palm, there is very little safety. And, you know, even just on the local roads of Parkland, we had a man killed right outside of one of the gated communities recently. You know, unfortunately, texting and driving, which is now illegal, but, you know, how do you catch someone? People are texting, they're in a rush. It's oil and vinegar. The cars are not paying attention. The cyclists may or may not be paying attention. And to have a quote-unquote bike lane that literally is right next to the car lane with no protection. You know, people have talked about a buffer zone between bike lanes.
Right.
But you need the real estate. Where are you putting it? Can you widen the roads in any of these locations? You're already, you know, encroaching on businesses and parking lots. It's just increasing. The numbers every year increase. I'm also amazed, back to the cyclists, how many people don't wear helmets. If it's inevitable that someone's going to go down, if you're going to go down at least once in your cycling career, how do you not have a helmet? You know, I can put your bones back together, but there ain't no neurosurgeon on the planet going to put your brain back together. And I see a lot of families where they got all their little kids, everyone's helmeted up, but mom and dad, for some unknown reason, think they're immune. They're not wearing a helmet on, you know, pretty crowded roads. And we have cyclists who look like they know what they're doing on the cycle roads that are popular down here with no helmet on their head. And that alone is just mind-boggling to me, how dangerous the roads are, because, you know, a broken bone is one thing, but if your head breaks, you know, you're either brain dead or dead. And that's just mind-boggling, and something that cyclists should be their own self-responsibility to do that.
That is true. So, you know, we used to be rabid, you need to wear a helmet, you need to wear a helmet. And then we came to the conclusion that, you know, there'll be people who will say, it's like it was with seatbelts. If they're not mandated, you're right, it should be something you self-determine. And I think that if you've ever, ever fallen, and everybody, I think once in your career, as you say, as a cyclist, everybody's going to fall. And, you know, a head injury is pretty awful. The helmets these days are so light. The wind goes through them. It's not like they're hot and heavy like they used to be when they were the old Bell V1 Pro helmets. But, you know, they're much different today. But you can't convince everybody. So tell me about the police in your area. How are they when there is a bicycle crash? Do they follow up with the person who's been hit? Do they follow up and get witnesses? Do they go after people who do hit and runs?
My personal experience in Parkland was pretty good so far. A lot of times you'll be riding on the road and then there's a turnoff into a community. And so you're going through the bike lane. You're not going to enter the turnoff. You're going to stay in your bike lane. And some cars are a little impatient. They try to cut you off to get into the community.
Yeah, right hook.
And I actually had a police officer pull a guy over who did that to me, almost hit my front tire about 2 months ago. And I stopped and I literally thanked the police officer for doing that. And I was really in shock. We don't have a ton of police officers randomly roaming our roads all the time. I've seen many, many crashes on A1A in the mornings, on weekends, and I always stop to help when I see it. I've never seen a police officer that happened to be there. A lot of these crashes are, the ones I see are bike to bike, no car involved. There are cases where, cars have been sort of impounded, people arrested, obviously, if they're truly at fault. But unfortunately, with the crowded roads, at fault is really probably a hard thing to determine. It's literally two people trying to occupy the same space. One's a whole lot bigger than the other. And they're just unfortunate accidents that we have to accept are occurring at increasing rates. And as a community, do something about it, because the cars are not going away and the bikes are not going away.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. He is an orthopedic specialist in Boca Raton, Florida. We're talking actually about his experiences. He lives in Parkland. He works in Boca Raton. Does Parkland have a bike police force? I mean, a policeman on bikes at all?
I've never seen them regularly. I think they come to large events. If we have concerts, I've seen a couple around.
Oh.
Because it's easier for them to come to sort of the grassy areas.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, it's, you know, kind of cop cars waiting in the bushes for traffic tickets.
Right.
Even downtown Fort Lauderdale and stuff. They roam the beaches a little bit, I guess, on weekends. But I don't see a large amount of them out there.
So you've become now a bike advocate, whether you want to call yourself that or not. What's the next thing you're going to do?
Well, I've contacted a friend of mine who used to be our local senator for Florida, and once the session starts again in the fall, he's going to put me in touch with state senators and congressmen in Florida, start there. And then I've connected with my representative to Washington, my House of Representatives, about many things, and I've reached out to him about biking. And you have to kind of see, you know, budgets and who's willing to tackle this. They have so many things going on. You know, obviously gun violence is sort of step one right now in America, but
no kidding.
These fatalities are increasing, and obviously not just fatality, injuries. Injuries cost money to hospitals, to society, loss of jobs, et cetera. So, and this is a hobby that's growing, and so, at least in Florida, I know it's not going away. And they should promote people biking to work and biking and not cluttering the roads with cars and polluting our air, right? There's so many benefits to cycling to society as a whole. Unfortunately, you know, places like Amsterdam seem to get it, but America doesn't, at least in most cities. It's challenging in large metropolitan areas. We also have a lot of tourists here who are lost or can't find their way. I'm sure a lot of cyclists get hit because someone is trying to figure out where they're going and not looking at the bike next to them in the bike lane. And that's just a reality of living in a state where there's a whole lot of tourists. So many contributions to the problem.
So there's one other question. I remembered what I wanted to ask you, and it was about cameras. Do you have a camera on your bike, like a GoPro or the Cycle IQ camera system?
I don't routinely, unless I'm going on like vacation, like our trip in Israel. I don't. It's just one less thing that I don't. I carry, you know, something to play a little music and lights, but I don't have a camera.
Well, I meant more in terms of capturing what's going on as opposed to taking pictures of scenery, you know, more about the...
Yeah, no, I know a lot of people do that on their cars now, but no, I haven't done it on my bicycle.
Okay. Well, as always, I really enjoy talking with you. You seem to always have a great grasp of whatever the situation is. And this is an interesting one because normally when we talk to people about what's going on, it's in metropolitan areas like New York, Cleveland, Chicago, Philadelphia. Parkland, we don't think of as a big urban, you know, city, and yet you are experiencing exactly the same problems as every place else.
Yep, it really is. It's, you know, these, unless you're living in like the desert where there's a whole lot of nothing, I think all of our populated areas are going to see this growing.
Well, we will talk again, of course. If I do not talk to you before you leave on your trip, have a wonderful time. Thank you so much for talking with us. We've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Hirsch. He is an orthopedic specialist out of Boca Raton, Florida. Have fun.
Thank you so much, Diane.
All right,
appreciate
take care.
It.
All right, bye.
All right, bye.
Dr. Jonathan Hirsch is an orthopedic specialist in Boca Raton, Florida. He lives and rides in Parkland. So let's take a short break, and when we come back, I have a couple of news stories for you before we head to the UK to speak with Luke Edwards-Evans. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's been another tough week in the cycling world with the loss of Bjørg Lambrecht, the young upcoming star of the Lotto Soudal team. Lambrecht, 22, was killed following a crash on Monday's third stage of the Tour of Poland after losing control of his bike and colliding with a concrete bridge over a ditch. According to the team doctor, quote, Bjørg died from a big liver laceration, which caused a massive internal hemorrhage. As a consequence, Bjørg suffered a cardiac arrest. Even though medical attention was swift, Bjørg would have needed a miracle, according to the doctor, a miracle he did not get. Tour de France champion Egan Bernal paid tribute to Lambrecht. I competed in many races against him. It's very tough. It makes me really sad, said Bernal on his return to Colombia on Wednesday. It was a terribly sad day. So in mentioning Egan Bernal, Velo News ran the following, and I certainly could not have said it better. Tour de France champion Egan Bernal was given a hero's welcome by around 10,000 people as he returned to his hometown of Zipaquirá, Colombia, on Wednesday to celebrate his historic achievement. The pint-sized 22-year-old climber became the first Colombian to win cycling's most prestigious race in only his second start. Quote, I'll never forget seeing so many people gathered for me, said the team Ineos rider from a stage on Zipaquirá's central square where fans and well-wishers had started gathering at 5 a.m. on what was also the 200th anniversary of Colombia's independence. Everything happens so fast that until now, when I see you there, I'm only just realizing what this means for Columbia, he told the cheering crowds. And the truth is that it makes me very proud to be able to give something to society and to give Columbia hope. Bernal's teammate, Geraint Thomas, is predicting that Bernal will win multiple tours as his career unfolds. This week, Bicycle Retailer reported that a Denver television station is reporting that police may have found the van involved in the hit-and-run collision that left industry veteran Andrew Bernstein in a very serious condition in the hospital. The Denver Channel said a tipster called police last Friday to say a van fitting the description was in Lafayette, Colorado, a town adjacent to Boulder where the collision occurred. Police are in contact with the van's registered owner, the station said, but no charges have been filed. Bernstein works at the industry marketing firm True Communications and is a former editor of Bicycling Magazine. He was struck on July 20th while cycling on Arapahoe Road in Boulder. The driver that hit him drove off, and Bernstein was discovered later by a passing motorist. Some broken vehicle parts were found at the scene, and police released photos from security cameras this week that they believe showed the van involved. And my last story is about the League of American Bicyclists. They're reporting that the Senate has passed a transportation bill that is, quote, great for bikes, unquote. How often do we hear those words? The article lays out the league's agenda and how the bill responds to it. Much of what is shown was part of the bike summit back in March. Whether the House will A, take up the bill, B, take it up and change it, or C, bring it to a vote is anybody's guess. The suggestion is always to contact your representatives. If you are interested in reading the article, you can log on to bikeleague.org and click on content. You can also find contact information for all your representatives on the site. So that's our news for this week. We'll take another short break and we'll get back to the show. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Diane Jenks, and you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Back in May, Triumph Books published an official Tour de France bike maintenance book by journalist Luke Edwards Evans. Beautifully illustrated and with outstanding explanations, the book takes you through the types of bikes used in the tour, the essential tools these pro mechanics use, offers you a glimpse into the hectic day of a pro tour mechanic, and gives us a chapter about classic tour bikes over the past 75 years, and how to care for them if you have one. Almost as important, Luke and I chat about this year's Tour de France and what he saw. Hi, Luke. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Hello, Diane. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad, thanks. Yeah, I'm still recovering from the Tour de France. I've got back about a week ago.
Well, what's interesting is we've been trying to put this interview together for even before the Tour de France, and it never occurred to me that that was going to be the obstacle. But now it's through, and we can have this conversation. So I'm really pleased.
Yeah, great. No, I thought it might be better if we chatted after the tour, because you see so much during the race that, you know, we can talk a little bit about the tour as well.
That would be awesome. So before we talk about your book, the official Tour de France bike maintenance book, which is really a well done tome here. I like this. Lots of great photographs, very well laid out, hardbound book. This is the kind of thing my listeners love. But I'd love to get some background on you. Can we do that?
Sure. I am a 50-something-year-old cycling journalist. I've done cycling for my whole career, really. And I've been writing about cycling since the 80s and 90s and right the way through. Mostly I'm a magazine, been working on magazines. I've been a magazine editor. So I was the editor of Winning Magazine, Cycle Sport Magazine, Cycling Active. So my whole career really has been in cycling journalism. But during that time, about 30 years ago, actually, I started in 89. I've always been a motorcyclist. And I started driving for the photographer Graham Watson in professional cycle races. every year. I've had a few breaks here and there. I've been lucky enough to be able to drive with primarily with Graham, and more recently with some French photographers on some of the big bike races. So that's how, you know, my access to the world of professional cycling has been through the journalism side, and then also through my life as a motorcycle driver on the bike races, where I'm often able to get behind the scenes and see how the mechanics work and how the riders operate behind the scenes. And I've had some super privileged access over the years.
I have to say, when you said winning and cycle sport, now I remember how I've seen your name. So,
yeah,
that makes lots of sense to me. But, wow, you've been actually driving for Graham Watson. I would love to find a way to talk to him, and I've never been able to get a hold of him. Maybe you and I should have a conversation about that, too. But
yeah,
anyway.
I'm sure we'd work something out. I'm sure he'd be more happy to talk to you.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your entry into the back room, where you have learned and written about the mechanics and the bikes that they're working on. I think people believe that a race mechanic is a glamorous job, and I'm not sure that's altogether true. So tell us a little bit about what you know about the mechanics themselves, and then we'll dive into your book, and then we'll talk about this year's tour.
Well, the mechanics are the heroes, really. I mean, they're the heroes of the book, and in my eyes, they're some of the hardest working people behind the scenes in pro cycling. I mean, we say these things like, oh, it must be a glamorous job. And then everyone says, no way, it's not. It's hard work. It's drudgery. It's endless hours. And but actually, the pro mechanic's job on a Tour de France is quite glamorous. I mean, it's their one chance of the year to really show off their craft in front of thousands of fans who every day are coming to the race starts and the finishes and finding their way to the team hotels. It's the one time of the year when the mechanics are actually working really in the public eye. And I think they enjoy that side of it. Okay, yeah, it's really hard work. There's no doubt about it. It's the most high-pressure, stressful 3 weeks of their whole year. They're having to work long hours on multiple machines for all the riders. There's superman of pressure during the stages as well to ensure that they are making quick wheel changes and are completely on top of their game. But it's a fun job. I mean, these guys are used to working very hard, but the Tour de France is a little bit like the riders who make it onto the 8-man squad for each team. If you're one of those four mechanics on a pro team at the Tour de France, you are at the top of your profession. It's a hard-working 3 weeks, but it's an enjoyable one too, I think.
Do they get paid well?
I think not fantastically well. I think they get paid probably a regular decent salary, and they by gum they earn it. They're working pretty much 12 months of the year these days. The cycling season's so the off season's so short that they have a pretty full year. And you find once a mechanic gets a job on a team, They're loath to give it up. I mean, they work for years and years, and they're on the road for years. It can be quite tough on their private lives, I think. But you can see the same faces every year on the same, you know, moving around the team sometimes. But it's a job for life for some of these guys.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Luke Edwards Evans. He's written a book called The Official Tour de France Bike Maintenance Book. It's a really interesting book. We are going to dive into it. But you know what? Let's talk a little bit about this year's tour. And it was a very unusual tour. People ended up on the podium every day we didn't expect. There were some crash outs we didn't expect. What did you see out there this year?
I agree with you. I think it was one of the most exciting tours almost in living memory. I mean, people were saying it was as good a tour as the tour when Greg LeMond and Laurent Fignon had that close finish, and that was 30 years ago. So yeah, it was excellent. I mean, the first 12 stages, I think, were won by individual riders. That's so unusual. Normally you get a sprinter will pop up and win 3 or 4 stages, but not this year. It was full of interest from the different stage winners, and then as the race progressed into the second and third week, there became a much more exciting battle for the top 10 and for the podium than we've seen in many years. So from my position on the motorbike, I was able to witness some of the fantastic moments, especially in the Alps, when you could see that the French hero, Julian Alaphilippe, was trying so hard to hold on to his yellow jersey. But we could see from where I was sitting, I could see him drifting slowly to the back of those small mountain groups and fighting out of the saddle as he tried to hold on to the wheels of the Team Ineos guys and the Jumbo Lotto guys. And then obviously to see Egan Bernal ride away on the big mountains, those final mountain stages at the end, was incredible. To see a Colombian not only climb well, but to get into a position to win the tour and then win the tour was such a historic tour. It was a really one of the all-time great tours.
Were you able to catch a lot of photography and come up with stories that you might end up writing into a book if it was that exciting a year, which it was, of course, from a perspective of somebody who's watching it?
Yeah, I mean, I like talking about it, and I've incredibly privileged access. It's the actual job of the driver on the Tour de France with a photographer. It's a tiring job.
Yeah, I'm sure.
There isn't much time at the end of the day or the beginning to actually do the job of a journalist. So when I'm riding my motorbike, that's pretty much all I'm concentrating on doing. It's only sometimes after the race that I kind of think, wow, those amazing, amazing adventures I've had on the race and things I've seen. So, yeah, I think there could be a book in it at some point.
So do you think Bernal will continue to do well? The Vuelta's coming up soon. Is he going to be racing the Vuelta?
No, I don't think so. I think they'll save Egan for a build up to next year's tour.
Okay.
Now.
All right.
And it'll present some interesting challenges for Team Ineos, because with Chris Froome seemingly making quite a good recovery from his horrific crash here last June, and Geraint Thomas also, you know, who finished second overall, it's not impossible that team could come to next year's tour with three team leaders.
Right.
But I think with Bernal, you know, he's 22. He's 10 years younger than Thomas and Froome. For the long-term future of the team, it's most likely that they will back Bernal, I think, to become the next big tour champion who could win multiple tours.
That would be so cool, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to just take a moment, and I don't know if you knew him, the young man who crashed this week and passed away. Was he in the tour this year, or was he not yet? He's a Lotto rider.
No, I didn't know Lambrecht, actually. Obviously today, everyone in cycling is thinking about him.
Sure.
And with great sadness, this is one of those very occasional tragedies that happens in cycling that actually brings everyone up short and makes you realise just how dangerous cycling can be.
Right.
No, he was a young 22-year-old star of the future, riding in the Tour of Poland. He almost certainly would have been a tour rider in the coming years. And it's just a very, very sad day.
It is. So we're going to take a real quick break. And when we come back, we're going to actually talk about the book. We are talking with Luke Edwards Evans. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Okay, we are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Luke Edwards Evans. What's really cool about Luke is he gets to ride on the motorcycle, and for the photographer at the tour, it's like, wow, what a cool job. But he's also written a great book. It's called The Official Tour de France Bike Maintenance Book. And we are going to talk about the book a little bit because we've been talking about the tour for this year and some of the other things about mechanics. So one of the things that I'd like to know is, what is the types of bikes that are used in the race? You actually break that down in the book, and it's one of the beginning chapters.
Yeah, every team comes to the tour with a truck full of bikes, up to 50 machines. The reason for that is that these days, so much hinges on trying to win a stage of the tour that it's worth the teams having bikes that are suited to the terrain for each kind of stage. So basically you have pretty much three or four different types of bikes for road stages. The first type, the most common for a flat or rolling stage, would be an aero road bike, which would be a carbon machine with more of an aerofoil profile for its for the tubes or the spars of the frame. And the wheels for that kind of bike would have a deeper carbon rim. All these things are designed to make the machine gain a few seconds per kilometre more over a conventional road machine. And then you've got, for the mountains, you might have a lighter frame, maybe not so aero, with lighter wheels and a smaller profile carbon rim. This might not have disc brakes. Many of the bikes in the tour now have got disc brakes. And I think seven stages this year were won by bikes with disc brakes. But in the mountains, there's still possibly a slight weight advantage to having a bike with traditional caliper brakes. And in fact, the Team Ineos this year, their Pinarellos, none of them had disc brakes. And they favoured extremely lightweight carbon wheels for the mountain stages. Then obviously for time trials, the teams bring their own specialist TT machines, and then these are the most aero machines of the lot, with tri-bars and obviously the most aerodynamic wheels, sometimes with disc brakes, which are increasingly more aerodynamic. But the main focus, I think, on machines in recent years has been aerodynamics, and in recent times the integration of components has helped that even more by actually making them conceal cables and wires for the electronic gears. So, you know, there's minimum each rider would have probably three different types of bikes for a race like the Tour de France. I mean, last year there was a big cobbled stage. CAT could introduce a fourth type of bike, which would primarily have wheels that were more suited for riding over rough, you know, Belgian pavé and cobbles. And that would have a wider rim with a fatter section tire. So there's dozens of bikes in the Tour de France inventory for every team. And even for a team, in the book, we talk about the team truck, and there can be up to 120 pairs of wheels in the truck, just to give riders options for different types of terrain and different types of conditions.
That brings up a question for me about tires, because we know that a super narrow tire may or may not be faster and probably isn't faster than a wider tire. What is the average tire for the let's say a road stage these days? Do you know? 700 by 25? It is 25. Yeah. Good. Okay. So we can convince all these 23 and 19 millimeter riders that no, even the tour riders ride 25. They're pretty funny, some of these people. Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Luke Edwards Evans. We're talking about his new book, The Official Tour de France Bike Maintenance Book. That's a lot of words, but that's okay. It's a cool book. I wanted to ask you about, because as I watch bikes come into our shop and I watch the new equipment, for example, SRAM's new group, And suddenly this brand new chain tool showed up in the shop because it turns out that once again, you need a different kind of chain tool to install the SRAM chain. What kinds of tool kits does somebody need to have? So you're saying that, you know, how to maintain your bike like the pros. I can't imagine all of us having all these tools, right? So which tools could we have and which tools should be left to the pros, do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, in the book, we detail all the different types of tools from the most basic Allen key, hex key type tools through to really quite specialist tools for setting up the bikes and measuring the bikes. I would say that the home mechanic can get by with quite a basic set of tools, starting with a decent set of Allen keys. And if you have them color-coded, that very much helps. You just pick out the differences between, say, the 4, 5, and the 6 mil Allen keys, which are the most commonly used ones. I mean, the pro mechanics, obviously, they've got every tool that they need, but some of them they won't use very often. And for the home mechanic, there's some jobs. For instance, if you wanted to change your headset bearings or your bottom bracket bearings, there's various specialist removal tools and presses, which it's probably worth you going to a bike shop to have fitted by a professional mechanic there. There's one tool that I think it is worth a home mechanic having, and it is quite a specialist tool, but it's a derailleur alignment tool.
Very good. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think that we were working with a very good mechanic called Rohan Dubash in the book. He helped with much of the picture shoots and gave me a lot of tips and advice. But many home mechanics, one of the jobs they want to do is maintain their gears and just ensure that the gears are absolutely changing as slickly as possible. That is not a difficult job in itself, but if you're having problems getting your gears to work as sweetly as possible, there is a chance that the gear itself, the derailleur itself, is not perfectly aligned, and that's one thing that you need to check, because with the way that these carbon frames are these days, it's quite easy for the gear hanger to get slightly bent, and if the derailleur is just slightly out of alignment, you will find it very difficult to get your gears spot on. And it's not expensive to replace a gear hanger on a carbon frame, and sometimes that can be the solution to your gears if they're not quite changing spot on.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a really good point, because a lot of people think, well, I've had these gears adjusted 3 million times and they still don't work. And it is just a tweak of that derailleur hanger. Good idea. So that brings up another question. Components change a lot. People want the newest, the latest, the greatest, whatever. How are these mechanics trained for this up-to-the-minute work on these new component groups? So SRAM comes out with a brand new group. Shimano comes out with a brand new group, whatever. How did they get trained ongoing if they're on the road all the time? Who's doing all? I mean, I know a professional mechanic understands this stuff inherently, sort of, but there are nuances to these new groups.
There are, and a lot of the, obviously, most of the group sets now used by professional riders are electronic.
Right.
The changes to the upgrades and the changes to the group sets and the derailleurs quite often are almost like software upgrades. And these mechanics have been around for quite a few years. They're not necessarily computer geeks.
That's
they
true.
So they are quite often, they are relying on seminars and in the winter with companies like SRAM, Campagnolo and Shimano might visit various team HQs and actually take the mechanics through the new upgrades they've made to their electronic gears. I mean, there's very little that the mechanics have not seen mechanically, if you like. I mean, there's very little that they need to learn on that score. But I think with their electronic gears, there are so many different variations of the way you can program the gears now that in the off season, many of the mechanics are actually looking at online videos and meeting with representatives of the component manufacturers just to get themselves up to speed for the new kit for the following season.
Sure, sure. That makes sense. That makes sense. You also take a dive in the book into crash damage, what to look for after a crash. These carbon bikes are dangerous once they crash, and oftentimes you don't see the damage. So what would somebody look for if you crash your bike? Now, we're still big believers in steel. So, you know, I mean, I certainly get carbon, but that's what these guys are riding.
Yeah. And you have to be very vigilant if you've had a crash on a carbon machine to check very finely for any kind of fine cracks that you might have appeared in the lacquer. I saw machines at the tour this year that been involved in crashes that literally just snapped in half.
Right.
Well, that's pretty obvious where the damage is.
Yeah, right.
But you're absolutely right, Diane. You need to be very careful when you've had a crash on a carbon machine. The best thing, if you're not sure, is to go to either a specialist bike shop or a specialist carbon repair outfit and ask them to test your machine. They can actually do a kind of X-ray on the frame just to see if there's any internal damage to a carbon frame, because actually if sometimes the damage is not visible, but it's internal, and it could over time get worse. So these carbon frames are very strong. I mean, the front ends, the forks are incredibly beefed up. And actually, when you see carbon frames that have been involved in big crashes, quite often the place where they've broken in the center, down in the center of the tubes, rather than at the front end. The front ends are so strong, when the wheel hits something, the forces are transferred further back down the frame, actually, and these carbon frames are breaking more in the center. So the forks quite often can take a massive impact, but you still need to, if you're not sure and you've had an impact, front end impact, you really should get it checked out by a professional at a bike shop.
I totally agree. Totally agree. There are two more things I want to talk about three more. Before I let you go. One is your chapter on personalizing your bike. What do you mean by that? What are those kinds of things?
Well, that was a fun chapter, actually, because we had Geraint Thomas's tour-winning bike from last year. And we had a lot of fun just going around, just trying to find the small things that the mechanic had done just to personalize the bike for him. And actually, on the Tour de France bikes, that's one of the areas where the mechanic who every day they've got a basic job to keep the bike on the road. These bikes are working machines. They're not necessarily as flashy, if you like, as a private customer might make their bike, but they still got this opportunity to personalize the bikes. And the bike that we looked at had a custom paint job with special paint on the inside of the chainstays. You can do such a lot with the bar tape, doing special super wrap on the bar tape and finishing it nicely on the end caps, just making sure that everything is aligned and you're using fancy tape to finish the wrap. There's things like on Geraint Thomas's Pinarello, the seat clamp. We think that was a CNC machined special seat clamp, which only he had on the, or only the team had on their Pinarellos. So there's various things. I mean, there's lots of ways of fitting tires now. So you make sure that the tire label is opposite the valve, and just all the things that a mechanic who's got a little bit of extra time on their hands can just do those little special things that make the bike stand out from a normal bike.
So I'm laughing because everything you're saying we've done. You know, when my husband types bars, it better be wrapped the same number of wraps on each side, right? And the same exact amount of tape better be left over on each side. So I totally get what you're saying.
They're, you got it.
They're so anal, these mechanics. All right, last chapter I want to talk about is your your classics. So you compiled a chapter about TDF race bikes from the 50s through the 80s, because I guess 90s aren't classic enough yet. So what did you find in compiling that chapter about the bikes that you think has changed the most?
Oh, I really wanted to do that, those chapters at the end, because I don't know how things are in the States, but over in Europe, there's quite a big scene over here for Eroica rides, or their retro cycle rides. And it's been fantastic, because it's led to a resurgence of interest in old bikes, and many cyclists have found machines from those eras, from the 50s through to the 80s and 90s, and have renovated them and are riding them and are appreciating those old, mostly steel bikes for what they were and for the eras that they evoke. And you can see in the book just how quaint and different those machines are to today's bikes. So it was very enjoyable to convey to the readers just how different those machines are, but in essence, how similar as well. So for instance, in the book, we show you how to, again, adjust the derailleurs. And the way the derailleur works is the same. It hasn't really changed, even with your electronic derailleurs. You still have to make sure that there's a limit to how far the derailleur goes in one direction than the other. And we just wanted to show where those limit screws are on the older style derailleurs so that people could maintain these old bikes themselves. So there's just enough info there just to help the cyclist who's bought an old bike keep that bike in good operational condition. But in terms of, you're saying how they change. Gosh, the materials, that's the difference, I think. There's obvious things like, yes, disc brakes, electronic gears, the pedals. Those technically have changed. You know, pedals have gone from toe clips and straps to quick-release ski-binding type pedals. That's a complete evolution of the pedals. Disc brakes. No one ever thought that bikes from the 80s would have disc brakes. They've completely changed the way that bikes not only stop, but also how you can design the wheel and what kind of tires you can use. And they've also enabled manufacturers to use much fatter tires, because you've got that clearance now around the forks and the stays. But I think, in essence, the main change is that, you know, bikes from the previous eras, they were made of steel, they were handmade, they were hand-finished. The wheels were alloy rims with steel spokes, maybe chromed, and alloy hubs. And those were hand-built wheels as well. These are things that we just don't really see in pro racing anymore. And those are the biggest difference. I mean, carbon fiber and the quality of the manufacturing, that's the biggest difference. The quality of the bearings, for instance, in the modern bikes is just so much higher than the bearings, bottom brackets and the headsets, which anyone who's ridden old bikes know you have to constantly keep an eye on and adjust. I think that's for me is the biggest difference, is the quality of the materials from those bikes, from those eras. That's the thing that's made the modern bike made of mostly carbon fiber and alloy and titanium. That's the difference.
Well, this has been a delightful conversation. How can people get a copy of your book?
Any decent bookshop in the States should have it. If you go online, it's the official Tour de France maintenance book. It's a Tour de France official book as well, and it's published by Carlton Books. So you should better find it online and maybe locate your local bookstore to order it if you've got one.
Well, and we will post a link to the publisher site. It's always nice to give them the first option to to have the book bought from them. I always like that.
Thanks, Diane.
Well, thank you, Luke. Luke Edwards Evans. The book, again, is the official Tour de France bike maintenance book. And I hope to talk with you again. You are fascinating.
Anytime.
All right.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Luke Edwards Evans joined me from his home in the UK. If you are interested in a copy of his book, the official Tour de France bike maintenance book, How to Prep Your Bike Like the Pros, you can find it in all the usual places. If you ordinarily go to a local bookstore and it doesn't have a copy of the book, you can ask them to order it for you. So that's our show for this week. My thanks to Dr. Jonathan Hirsch and to Luke for joining me. Next week, we have what I think will be a show of great interest to anyone who has followed bike racing in any form over the past 40 years. Think landscapes. So thanks for listening. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook, send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without the E, leave a comment or ask a question on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. And won't you please take a moment to rate the podcast on your preferred app. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.